of all the dangers you will face.
Freeze well.
Of all the thrills you will experience, no adventure is bigger than Batman and Robin.
I'm asking you, friend, partner, will you help me?
Arnold Schwarzenegger, George Clooney, Chris O'Donnell, Uma Thurman, Alicia Silverstone.
Partners?
Partners.
Partners.
Batman and Robin.
Welcome to Podcast Action Hero, the show that hates to disappoint you, but our rubber lips are immune to your charms.
Get to the chopper!
I want to ask you a bunch of questions.
Hey, Christmas tree!
And I want to have them answered immediately.
I'm not a pervert! You son of a bitch!
My neighbors are very sensitive.
Get your ass to Mars.
I'm not shitting on you.
Fuck you, asshole.
Hi, I'm Gavin.
I'm Jamie.
And this is the podcast where we basically talk about Arnold Schwarzenegger films for an hour. And in this episode, we are talking about 1997's Batman and Robin.
I mean, it had to happen eventually, didn't it?
Literally by the format of the show, yeah. It's at some point, it was going to come out of the Wheel of Pain. I'm, on the one hand, glad it took this long, but on the other hand, sad that it happened anyway.
Yeah.
I think I was sort of hoping that the complex database that we use to store the list of films, Excel spreadsheet, I think I was hoping it would corrupt somehow and we'd lose all the shit films. But no, in fact, I think we've already had quite a few of the shit films, haven't we? So
yeah, in fact, quite a lot of them.
Mm.
Can only go uphill from here.
We're getting ahead of ourselves maybe, Jamie. What is your history with this piece of shit film?
I've actually got an odd history with this one. I watched this in part in a friend's house in America. It was as part of this thing that I think it was like a 4-hour TV show called Dinner and a Movie. And I've not looked it up since, so this might all be misremembering. But the point of this show was, it was they showed some of the film and then they'd cut back to the presenter who'd be showing you how to make a meal. They keep cutting back and forth between the film and this cookery show. But also, you know what American TV is like for adverts.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, this 2-hour film ended up being around 4 hours. And I only saw a bit of it, but like, that's no way to watch a film. Like, all my memories are of lasagna or something.
Well, it's also no way to cook a meal. Like, it's like a 4-hour fucking recipe.
Yeah, the worst of both worlds, basically.
I'm both not following this film and I've burnt this cake. Tell me the meal was at least like, I don't know, like an ice cream cake. It was something frozen. It was something thematically.
Honestly, it couldn't tell you. I lost patience. I'm not going to sit there for 4 hours. I'm guessing you've got a more straightforward but probably horrific history with it.
So I don't know if we've mentioned this in the podcast before, but you may know that I'm a massive Batman fan.
Mm-hmm.
So like the wall that I'm facing now, which is behind my microphone and behind my monitor, it's like a Batman theme. In fact, the room that I'm sat in now, my home office / studio / Gav Cave, is like a grey colour. And I picked it because it's kind of like a Batman-y sort of grey colour. And so I'm a huge Batman fan. And I was when I was a little kid. I guess in the same way that we've talked about a lot of the Schwarzenegger films is I don't remember the first time I've seen a lot of those films. I also don't remember the first time that I saw one of the Batman films. But I remember being a little kid, and like I had little tracing kits where you could draw the Michael Keaton Batman and the Jack Nicholson Joker. And I remember I used to have this kit. It was these plastic molds, or these like rubber mold, and you pour plaster of Paris into them, and it'd be like a little like mold that you could paint.
I remember them.
Right.
Yeah, they were kind of like these like dark red rubber glove kind of thing.
Exactly. And you pour out these plaster castings, and then you paint them. I guess with like poster paints or whatever. And there's Batman and Joker, and yeah, I was this. Just massive fan, and I'd never seen a Batman film at the cinema. I was definitely too young for the first one, probably a bit too young for Batman Returns. I don't know why I didn't get Batman Forever when that came out, because I certainly would have been old enough, and probably old enough to go on my own as well. But certainly when Batman and Robin came along, I was like, right, I'm going to go and see one in the cinema. And it just so happened that I saw it in a really small cinema in South Wales in the United Kingdom, a little town called Newquay. Shout out to my Newquay cardigan people. And the thing is, the films they showed there, they were like usually a year after they'd actually been out at the cinema. Listeners might recall, old listeners, maybe people our sort of age, Jamie, they might recall that when a film came out at the cinema, you then had to wait about 6 months for it to come out on video afterwards. And then six months after that, it'd be on like satellite TV. And up to a year later, it'd then be on like normal terrestrial TV, maybe even longer, right?
Oh, yeah. Jurassic Park was about 3 years.
Right. And so just to put this into a perspective for you then, this small cinema, which was a town hall in this little town called Newquay, the films that they had on there were almost to the point where they were coming on TV. They're like...
Oh, my God.
So this is a 1997 film. It's probably like late 1998 when this thing was coming out of the cinema in this little town. Anyway, so I saw it. It was like a town hall. It had all the plastic chairs out, and they just had it projected onto this screen at the back of the room. And I remember being so excited to watch this film. 97, I would have been 14, something like that. And even at 14, I still recognised that this was not a good film. And again, I'd probably seen all the other Batman films by that point, and I had a really good idea going into this as to what I expected and what I wanted. And I guess like the cinema going public in general, it was not what they expected and not what they wanted either. That's my history with this film. And to be honest, mate, I don't think I've ever watched it in full since then. I've maybe seen snippets of it, but I've been in protest up until this point. I am not going to watch this film, but here we are.
In a roundabout way, I'm responsible for you having to go through this trauma for a second time.
Exactly. Thanks, mate.
Yeah, no problem. I live to serve. I normally do a synopsis. Mm-hmm. The synopsis I'm going to give this time is Batman and Robin fight Mr. Freeze and Poison Ivy, and they win.
Spoilers.
Also, Alfred nearly dies, but doesn't. And Batgirl's in it. The story isn't really a story. It's just set pieces.
Mm-hmm.
To the point where there are a few story beats, it's like, this doesn't feel right. It's from another film or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm more interested in than talking about the actual story is... I'm not like a Batman fan. I used to quite like, you know, superhero comics and stuff, and then the first few years of superhero movies, but never particularly Batman or whatever. So do you feel that this is offensive as a Batman film? Or like, because like a lot of people are like, Batman isn't this. So like, how did you respond to it at the time in terms of like being a Batman fan?
I feel like I responded to it in a couple of ways. One of them as a Batman fan was, look, this just wasn't my Batman.
Right.
One of the behind-the-scenes things that I was watching after we'd watched the film, there was I can't remember who they were interviewing on the behind-the-scenes thing. In fact, I say behind-the-scenes, it was like a retrospective, so that was even better, because rather than it being people on the press junkets and the promotional stuff going, oh, yeah, it's a really exciting new take on the characters, and there was none of that, because it was like a 10 years later retrospective, and they're all...
It was a mix.
Right.
Because if you watch the same one I did, you had Chris O'Donnell was talking about it in the past tense, mm-hmm. But Arnold was talking about it on set.
Right, okay.
Because Arnold, surprisingly, was very excited about it. One of the best scripts he's ever written.
One of the people they were interviewing on this retrospective thing that mentioned the idea that when you look at the Batman, Batman Returns, Batman Forever, Batman and Robin, they each reflect a different phase in the Batman comics, and how the first one was sort of the early 1930s and the second one was more like the 1940s, 1950s, and so on and so forth, and how Batman and Robin, this 1997 film, was much more reflecting the 1960s camp aesthetic.
Yeah.
Coming back to the question you asked, I'm not sure if this is necessarily my feeling at the time, but thinking about it now, that's the way I'm interpreting it. Do you know what? I can recognise that I don't have to be as angry about this thing as I used to be, because it's okay, it's just not my Batman. My Batman was maybe Batman and Batman Returns, and then Batman Forever was all right, and Batman and Robin not so much. So it's just, they just weren't my Batman. But I'm sure there were some people out there who loved these films.
Yeah.
Maybe. They just didn't go to the cinema to watch him.
Well, I mean, I've gone through the Letterboxd reviews, and there is a strong kind of movement to not so much forgive it as just embrace it as being like high camp. It's almost like got a Rocky Horror kind of following now.
Well, this is it's an artifact, right? And
yeah,
so this is, in fact, I didn't necessarily quite finish what I was going to say because I got sidetracked in my own rambling. But there was two parts to me. There was the Batman fan who watched it and was massively disappointed, but also, when by the time I was entering my mid-teens, I was starting to consider myself a little bit of a cinema buff, and I was starting to get more like different types of films, and I felt started to recognise what a good quality film was. And so I just felt watching this film, at least originally, I enjoyed neither of those things. Neither was it a good Batman film, neither was it just a good film. It was clearly, it was essentially, it was a 2-hour toy commercial.
Yeah.
I even recognised that at the time. It's like, this is just, it's a send-up. It's an advert. It's camp.
I think with time, there's a certain amount of appreciation that some people are going to have for this now in terms of practical sets and effects and production design. We're into our third decade of CGI, mm-hmm. which is getting increasingly shonky and muddy because they're relying on so much of it, given such short deadlines and that kind of thing. And there's something about watching a film, regardless of quality, from an era where you could build something and have people interact with it on set, even if it looks like the stage for American Gladiators mm-hmm. or something like that, which it kind of does in places here. There used to be, what was it called, Ice Warriors on ITV?
That was only for a year though, surely, wasn't it?
Was it 1998 by any chance?
Probably was, yeah.
Someone just watched one of these fight scenes and went, that'll do, let's have that on prime time. If nothing else, it took a big swing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it probably didn't at the time. It was just where films like that were going. You had like The Phantom and The Shadow and all those kind of things where they're corny. And this was just extra corny. In retrospect, you look back on it now and it's like, at least they weren't playing it safe.
I think they were at once playing it extremely safe and not safe at all. It seemed on one hand, on the surface of it, maybe it was a big gamble because they went super campy, super over the top. And based on the success of the previous films, was a huge gamble because the previous films seemed like they'd been successful based on the more adult nature. Less so Batman Forever. Mm. You know, you can almost see like a little bit of a trajectory from Batman Returns down to Batman Forever. And then it almost seems like Batman and Robin was a logical progression of the simplification or the, I don't know what you'd call it, to make the series for a younger audience. So here's the thing, right? I don't think they were going for camp. I don't think that's what they were...
Really?
I don't think they were going for camp. I don't think they were making like a statement about being like poppy or anything like that. I don't think that was the intention. I think the intention was that we want to make this look as much like an old comic as possible. And I think, and again, even in some of the retrospective or the behind-the-scenes stuff that I watched, they talked about how old comics were all primary colours. And that's why you had the Batman 1960s TV series was like all these bright colours to reflect
mm-hmm.
the comics. So there was a little bit of like that aesthetic going in there. But ultimately, it was about making it something that they could package into toys to make it attractive to kids. Kids like bright colours and all these kind of things. And if you can do different colours, and especially if you can give every single character multiple costumes that are all these different colours, then you can sell multiple toys. So that's what I mean by, on the one hand, it was maybe like a bold move because they were doing something wildly different. But on the other hand, it was not at all because it was deliberately calculated to be super safe in terms of how much merchandise they could shift off the back of it.
Oh, merchandise, yeah. Marketability, yeah. If you don't watch the film, you might think there's something to it. It's the actual content of the film that lets it down. Well, I mean, that's just true of any film. But obviously the script is bollocks. If there's one line of dialogue that's more than 12 words long, it's probably been cut or it's being said by Alfred.
Yeah.
Alfred being the only person in this film with any kind of gravitas, and even he's hamming it up.
Even he's desperate for the sweet release of death to get out of this film.
Yeah, and the fact that he doesn't die at the end, I almost felt like the guy playing Alfred was like, oh, they might want me for the number 5. Just like, you could almost see the relief in his face. His kind of cartoonish overacting as he's on his deathbed almost looked like he was trying not to laugh at how happy he was to be able to get out of this series. But I kind of disagree with you on the it not being intentionally like going for camp, because I don't think there's a single frame of this film that wasn't intentional, that wasn't like highly engineered by Joel Schumacher to do. Like, look at the other films he's done, right? He was doing A Time to Kill between the two Batman movies. He's done stuff like, oh, well, Lost Boys is probably a bad example because that's about as camp as he gets in the 80s. But stuff like Tigerland, Phone Booth. This is obviously, he's in a way misrepresenting comics, certainly comics of the era, because the 90s was all about the grim and gritty. You know, this was around the time that Batman had his back broken or whatever, wasn't it? But he's looking at it and kind of going, right, I'm just going to throw everything at this and go, in a particular direction, and that direction is just full camp. I'm sure that he's intentional about this, because if he wanted to take it seriously, he's got form in that regard. He knows exactly how to get a decent script out of a, I suppose, film a decent script or maybe wing it if he has to. I don't think any of this is accidental.
Well, I hear what you're saying, but even he has himself said that he wanted to reboot it, didn't he? After Batman Forever, he wanted to reboot. He wanted to do Frank Miller's Batman Year One. He wanted to go dark and he wanted to go much simpler with it. Mm. But the studio were like, no, after the success of the last one, we want more of that. To my mind, I'm just based on the limited stuff that I've seen and that I've read, is that, okay, I will perhaps concede that Joel Schumacher then went, well, if that's what you want, well, strap in, boys, because we're fucking going to go over the top.
Well, here's my excuse. Here's my excuse to do this big blowout camp classic. In the behind-the-scenes stuff, he says, I decided not to come back for a fifth one. Wikipedia, which for, you know, whatever that's worth, says he was never invited back because he basically killed the franchise.
Was it like a, you can't quit, you're fired?
Well, maybe it's a case of, like, he wasn't going to get it, but he also would never have come back for number five. Because I feel like this was him making himself almost unemployable by them again.
It reminds me of years and years and years ago when I was in my late-ish teens. I was in a, you can call it a relationship, with a young woman who, it was awful. We were only sort of seeing each other for a few weeks, maybe a couple months or so, and it was like a really, really bad match. And it's one of them where, you know, when like two people are completely unhappy, but neither one of them has the guts to do anything about it. And then one night, we went out to the pub for a few drinks, and I spent most of the night playing pool with one of my mates, and she was with one of her mates. And then towards the end of the night, I was like, I'm going to say it. I'm going to break up with her. And so we went off and we were sort of walking in silence for a few minutes, and I took a breath, and she said, Gavin, I want to break up. And I was like, whoa, it was that sort of like, no, you can't dump me, I'm dumping you. As an older person, if that happened to me now, I'd say I absolutely agree, but at the time I was like, no. So I wonder if that's what Joel Schumacher is like. He's like, Warner Brothers dumps him and he's like, no, I was gonna break up with him anyway.
Yeah, I can 100% see that. Yeah, speaking of relationships, Batman and Robin in this film. We've not talked about Arnold at all yet, but we will get to him. Batman and Robin in this film are basically a married couple, right? Having a tiff. Just getting jealous of each other because someone's getting in the way.
They're like a swingers. Right, you know, they yeah, say yeah. Like you know, the swingers thing, it never really works because you bring a third person into that dynamic and then you're always going to be wondering, are they more attracted to them or more attracted to you? So it's like they're a couple of like older swingers.
And in this case, the third person is Uma Thurman, who can, Poison Ivy, who can hypnotise them with love dust, which wasn't named, and I wrote down in my notes, oh, she's got love dust, and then later on she says, my love dust had an effect or something. I was like, oh, they just went route one on that. Yeah. They didn't think of an extra good name.
You can imagine like the writer's table, I'm like, right, let's come up with a name for this love dust, and I'm like, done, next.
I guess when you think about it, this is a character called Batman, who's a man who looks a bit like a bat, so you know, they do have form in that regard. Should we talk about Arnie?
Can do. Just before we do, I know that we've got like an hour format for this podcast is really loose, and sometimes we talk about the film start to finish and sometimes we don't, and we just bounce around all the place. So I recognise that this is one of the latter. This is one of those ones where we are going to bounce all around the place, and that's absolutely fine. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to address my first note from this film is in the opening credits, the opening titles, it has the Batman logo that appears, and then it's got the Robin logo in it, and then it freezes over. And my first note was, that's like the Dark Knight Rises. In the Dark Knight Rises, it comes on with the Batman logo, and then it freezes over. And I'm like, Christopher Nolan, you cheap bastard, you stole. You stole that from...
If you're going to steal from the best.
A good artist creates, a great artist steals. An amazing artist steals from Joel Schumacher.
Wow. And then mere seconds after that, Arnold Schwarzenegger, first billing.
Yeah, I believe the...
Which isn't unusual in the Batman series, because it's like Jack Nicholson had the same in the first Batman, right?
Uh-huh. But then, I believe it was Jack Nicholson the first, then Michael Keaton, the second one Michael Keaton, then probably Danny DeVito, I imagine. And then it would have been Val Kilmer and Tommy Lee Jones. I'm almost a little bit surprised. In fact, I could be wrong because I've done zero research on this. I would have thought Tommy Lee Jones would have like kicked up a stink if he didn't get top billing on Batman Forever. But
really, is he that kind of person? I'll say that again. Is he that kind of person?
I don't know.
Is he that kind of person? I'm more surprised that Jim Carrey didn't try to get top billing, because that was like, what, 1 year after his Ace Ventura, The Mask and Dumb and Dumber triple bill?
Maybe, but 1 year. I do wonder, having done zero research on the film that we're not talking about, that if he hadn't already signed up to this before all of those had hit, in terms of...
He can't have done, surely. Why would anyone think of him as the bad guy for a major blockbuster if he hadn't? Because that was the first year anyone really paid attention to him. Mm.
Yeah, so I wonder if he was already committed to that. Real sidebar on this one, if that's the right word to use, it almost certainly isn't. But have you heard the story about like Tommy Lee Jones and Jim Carrey, and how much Tommy Lee Jones hated Jim Carrey as well?
No, but it makes me like Tommy Lee Jones.
Yes, he really hates him. And apparently Jim Carrey didn't necessarily realise this, because like there's rumours that there was like a rivalry on set, because Two-Face as a character isn't necessarily like this massively over-the-top sort of character, or at least, you know, one half of him isn't a massively over-the-top character in the comics, right? Mm-hmm. But in Batman Forever, they're clearly trying to outdo each other. Chew more
going bigger and bigger.
Bigger and bigger and bigger. So there was rumours there was like an on-set rivalry between them. But I saw Jim Carrey on a talk show, might be Letterman or something like that, and he talks about going into a restaurant, and he walks in there and he sees that Tommy Lee Jones is in there, and he goes over and he's like, "How are you doing, Tommy Lee Jones?" And Tommy Lee Jones like leans into him really close to his ear and he goes, "I hate you."
Oh my god. That's amazing. So,
Bat nipples.
Do you want to talk about bat nipples, or do you want to talk about Arnold's performance?
I think we should talk some more about bat nipples.
Let's talk about bat nipples.
I think without...
Baby.
Yeah, no, we can absolutely skip the whole sort of bat nipples thing. The weird thing is... A possible concern that I've got here is that in terms of screen time, there is actually quite a lot of Arnold. Considering it's an ensemble cast, he's earned his top billing on this one, because he's in it for the vast majority of the film. He's got some really, really good screen time. Mm-hmm. That's good. In terms of quantity of material that he generates for the film, though, is really minimal. Because I know we've said this about a few films that we've watched, and I think we said it when we talked about Twins last time, right, was this is just a film where stuff happens. And we say it every time, well, that is literally the definition of like every film. It's a film, you know. But literally, this is a film not where stuff happens. This is a film where the same thing happens repeatedly every 5 to 10 minutes.
It's like you're watching a compilation on YouTube of Mr. Freeze's best bits.
And I'm sure you can find this. I have no doubt this is going to be on YouTube. If you search just like Mr. Freeze quotes from Batman and Robin, you will have every single one of that. Because every single one is a pun, really, isn't it? It's a pun about ice.
There's like three lines that aren't puns.
Right.
And nearly all of those lines have got the words the bat and the bird.
And so you could watch the supercut on YouTube of Arnold Schwarzenegger doing all of his Mr. Freeze lines. Watch all those. It'll probably last for 5, maximum 10 minutes. You watch it all, and you can do that and lose none of the context, none of the nuance, because there isn't any at all. So he's on the screen a lot, but he's not really saying much of anything to contribute, to move the plot forward, to...
No.
Well, there is no plot to move forward, right?
And again, you know, like we've often said that he's as good as the material you give him. In this case, I think he's better than the material you give him, because I think his actual performance and the energy, he knows what film he's in. He's enjoying doing what he's doing. And he's really putting a lot of like animation into these puns, because he's got nothing else. This is a tragic character that I don't know much about the comics version, but in the animated series, I remember he was like a real tragic character that is. It's the same storyline. His wife was dying. It was like a thematic thing. He's cold because his heart's cold, and he even says that in this film.
Yeah, just in case you didn't get it. Just
yeah,
just in case it wasn't clear, he's going to spell it out.
Right, but the film's not concerned with giving this character any kind of gravitas at all. So neither's Arnold. He's like, well, the elements are here. You can. This is his story. It's faithful, I guess. But he's kind of like, he's going out on a stage. It's like Batman on Ice, literally. It's like,
I went to see that. You
know, he's going out and he's playing to the raft. What? That was a thing?
Batman on Ice was a thing.
Was it after this?
Yeah. I went to see it in, I don't know, like 2012, 2013. You didn't know that? I thought.
No, God, I knew you then.
I'm sorry I didn't invite you.
Don't worry, I wouldn't have come.
It was... Do you know what? This is, so I'm interrupting you really briefly, but it's Batman on Ice sat somewhere between, believe it or not, Batman Forever and Batman and Robin, style-wise. It sat somewhere in the middle. It was like...
Okay.
It was still doing some of the darker stuff, and it was still doing some of the super camp stuff. But yeah, it was kind of both.
Wow. I literally had no idea that was a thing. When I said it, I was just trying to think of a comparison, you know, in terms of like Arnold sort of playing to the back seats kind of thing, you know, really putting his operatic sort of cartoonish best on. And I genuinely think because this film is like that, he's the best thing about this whole film.
It is. And I think you're absolutely right. He knows what film he's in, and he seems to have dialed the performance in perfectly. In terms of he's just arch villainy enough, he's just sort of camp enough, he's just over the top enough. Yeah, he's great. One thing that occurred to me is, because I know what the conversation we're going to have later is, you know, when we rate this film, and I've been thinking about where I would place this in terms of, for my personal sort of chart, where this lies, and maybe we'll talk about that later, but this film came out the year after Jingle All the Way.
Okay.
So Jingle All the Way is 1996, this came out 1997, and I think, if I recall correctly, back when we did Jingle All the Way, we talked about how Schwarzenegger had mentioned that he had a concern that he had made a lot of films that his kids could never see, or, you know, not until they were adults, he wouldn't want them to watch Terminator and all those kind of films. And so he wanted to make some films that his kids could watch, and especially considering around about this time he was having his heart surgery as well, so he was very limited in terms of, you know, the action things he could be insured for as well. So this, I think this is another one of these films where he was given the opportunity to make a film and he could say, A, I can still make a film because it's not going to be that action-packed. Incidentally, you know, we're talking about, I'm going all over the place here, but he's in this film quite a lot. Apparently he's not in this film quite a lot. Apparently his stunt double is in this film quite a lot.
Yeah, do you see the thing where Chris O'Donnell said, I never actually was in any scenes with Arnold at all?
Exactly.
It's like you spoke to him on set, but he was never in a scene with him. It was always a stunt double.
Exactly, so...
I mean, understandably, because like, apparently Arnold had it in his contract that he was only going to work, I think it was either 8 or 10 hours a day, which, you know, he's reasonable. That's what most of us work. But in Hollywood, obviously, you're expected to work until you drop. And so, as well as getting top billing and quite a lot of money, I think it's something like a good chunk of the budget anyway, something like $10
million. He was paid $25 million for this.
Oh, okay. I massively underestimated it.
Highest paid at the time. And he broke his own record a little bit later with Terminator 3 Rise of the Machines, is what I read.
Wow.
This film.
That's got to be... Based on how the movie star thing has kind of gone away recently, I wonder if that's still the record.
Maybe.
So Arnold, at this point, wants to make more films that his kids can watch. There's a moment in this film where Poison Ivy's trying to seduce Robin, and he says, I need to see a sign that you've changed your ways. And she says, slippery when wet? That's what you want to show your kids, is it, Arnold? That kind of filth.
Thing is, that is exactly the sort of joke. That's the one where you can imagine that being in the cinema and you can just hear like a dad in the back going and like,
What does that mean, Dad? Shut up. Ask your mum.
Well, you know, when we were walking in, we saw that sign where somebody had like been sick on floor and, you know, and it was like that. It just means, you know, because it means dangerous, doesn't it?
All right, okay, Dad.
He also, she really likes Bon Jovi. 80s album.
There was a bit in this as well where, is it where Arnold turns up and he's like freezing the museum and all that sort of stuff, and the cops come in, and Arnold's Mr. Freeze is like, Mr. Freeze is the name, remember it well. He's talking like Werner Herzog. And then I was thinking, I would love to see this film where Mr. Freeze is played by Werner Herzog.
Oh, do you know what? He's actually closer to the version of the character I know of.
It'd be amazing. Tonight's forecast, there's Art Freeze coming.
Okay, right. Speaking of his ice puns, mm-hmm. of which there is nothing but, there's one really early on that I made a note of, and I want to just see whether you heard it as well. In the very first scene of the film, Batman and Robin leaving the Batcave, having some, what I think is meant to pass for friendly banter, but he's actually just really bad dialogue. Mm-hmm. On the way, Commissioner Gordon pops up with some kind of, his line of dialogue is something like, Batman, a new villain has turned up. What? That's what a kid would write. Oh, there's a new villain over there. Go and catch him.
It's also the sort of line that would appear in it at the beginning of a toy advert as well.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And then you just see like a kid's hand coming holding like a Bane figure.
Send Batman! Yeah, but in the first scene, Mr. Freeze is robbing a museum of like a massive diamond.
Mm-hmm.
The Natural History Museum, I guess, in Gotham. It's like it's got a dinosaur in it that Batman slides down.
Let's come back and talk about that in a minute, please.
Yeah, but also, there's a rocket in there. And I'm not sure whether it's meant to be a museum item or whether Mr. Freeze is meant to have made it as part of his getaway plan, because he leaves in this rocket, but then Batman climbs on and Robin climb on to try and stop him.
Yep.
And then halfway, when he's up in the stratosphere, he decides he's going to bail and he just jumps out and leaves them, assuming they're going to die and their hearts will freeze, I think he says. Okay, A, if that was a working rocket, it shouldn't be in a museum. But all of this is to say, when he bails out the rocket, he jumps out and says, freeze well. That's not a pun. What's it meant to be? Like, freeze well's not a thing. It's not like be well or something like that. Or I don't get what it's meant to be. It's one of his very first puns in the first, like, 10 minutes of the film. It kind of sets the tone, really.
Oh, it's like what does Chang say in Community when he's trying to bring in that catchphrase? It's like bear out or something like that. And they're going,
bear down for midterms.
That's it, bear down for midterms. And they're going, what do you mean? And he's like, bear down. It's that sort of thing. It doesn't mean anything. Maybe it was like literally like, maybe it was Arnold. He wanted to say that thing. And they're like, what do you mean, Arnold? And he just started crying. And they're like, okay, yeah, it's fine, you can say it.
yeah, it was like, it was Arnold's improv on the day, because the original line was like, eat shit, Batman. He's like, I want my kids to see this. Well, all right then, you come up with something. Freeze well.
Oh god, it could have had anything. Like, it would have made the same amount of sense, that is none. He could have said freeze on day of purchase, or you know, suitable for home freezing.
I mean, towards the end of the film, they were reusing quite a lot of ice puns, and I thought, yeah, they probably could have used... Oh, you should have been there, script doctor, man.
In fact, I'm just thinking, sorry, I was just getting hung up on my own pun there. It wasn't even a pun again. It's like, at the end of this, when they are thawing all the buildings out, which they definitely don't thaw everyone out, they sort of like skim it around a little bit, but that would have been the perfect point to say defrost thoroughly before heating or something. They could have.
So we've established that Arnold's pretty good in this film. One of the high points.
Mm-hmm.
I said he was the best film, best thing in the film, and I kind of think I might have been slightly wrong, but I'll come to that later. What do you think of Poison Ivy, Uma Thurman?
Again, I think she knows exactly what film she's in. I don't think she's not gotten lost anywhere. She's not turned up thinking it's going to be one thing or the other. She knows exactly what's going on. So, you know what? I've been banging on, I've been slagging this film off for basically since we started the podcast and dreading it coming up. But there's not really anybody in this film who is acting in a way that they think they should be in another film. There is nobody really who's delivering. Even like George Clooney, who, bless him, he's got fuck all to do in this film, right? Turns up and he...
Because his thing is, like, Batman's meant to be kind of like, he's quippy, but he's also meant to be quite stoic and serious. He's like the straight man.
Yeah.
A straight man in this film has got nothing to work with.
No, not at all. And they do give him a couple of quippy lines, some almost like Bond level puns,
there's Don't Leave Home Without It.
Yeah, when he gets the, is it a MasterCard or an American Express or whatever it is, it's his black card, and it says, valid until forever, which if IMDb trivia would have you believe is some kind of reference to the previous film. I just think it's meant to suggest that he's got a bottomless credit limit.
I mean, I don't know. I can see both sides of that.
But yeah, what I liked about Uma Thurman as Poison Ivy, I liked how she was sort of leaning into the old sort of the femme fatale sort of thing. You know, she was really doing almost like the transatlantic accent that a lot of the women did.
Mid-Atlantic,
that was it, yeah.
Yeah, the kind of like the His Girl Friday, All About Eve kind of, well, that's a fine how do you do.
Yeah, exactly. So I liked that. Again, she knew what she was doing. Her puns worked for what they were. She was fine. She was one of the, easily, between her and Schwarzenegger, they stole this film.
Oh, God, yeah.
And nobody else seems to have much of anything else to do. It was their show, 100%.
But that's what kind of bugs me, because it suggests that this film only works on the level of cheap puns.
It does only work on the level of cheap puns.
But like, it feels like that's all they were ever aiming for. And it kind of annoys me that I'm almost insulted that they didn't try harder.
It makes me wonder, with the fact that this film only works on the basis of the puns and the one-liners, is that how far the producers and the studio and the toy manufacturers got their like fingers into the pie to say that, like, maybe they had in mind, you know, like those plushie dolls with like the pull string on the back of it, like the Krusty the Clown dolls in The Simpsons, where you pull it and it says a line.
Mm.
Is that what they were making? Were they going to make like Mr. Freeze action figures where you press a button and it goes, "There's a freeze coming"? And so,
I bet that exists.
Yeah, every single line had to be something where you could put it in a toy and press a button.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like it's reverse engineered, like toys first, film as an afterthought, film as a vehicle to. You know, it's as cynical as everyone used to say about like 80s cartoons, like He-Man and whatever. It was just only exists to promote the toys. It feels like the same for this, right?
I can't remember if we've spoken about it before. I've got it in my head from somewhere, but the idea of who's that filmmaker, the director who always smokes a lot and he's got the big grey hair?
David Lynch?
Yeah, that guy. I heard David Lynch saying, like, if you want to make a film, you basically get like 20-odd index cards and you put them up on the wall and you write scenes on them. And when you've got a certain amount of scenes, that's your film, and then you just got to rearrange those. I wonder if they've sort of taken that approach, but rather than writing scenes, they've written zingy one-liners and put them up on a wall and gone, right, those are the one-liners, now let's write a film around it.
That sounds like it's genuinely plausible, like not even being funny about it. I think that might have actually been how they started. And it's weird to think that currently in cinemas right now, number one film is Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning, part one. And I've just been listening to interviews about that recently, and apparently they start these films by just coming up with stunts and then working out how they can make a story to have those stunts all happen in sequence.
It's like Tom Cruise walking in and goes, here's what I really want to do.
Literally exactly that. That's how they make Mission Impossible films. And apparently it sounds to me like a minor miracle that they've done as well as they have, because I don't see an awful lot of difference between starting stunts first, story, characters second, than puns first, story and characters second, or toys first, you know.
Yeah, I guess this is it. It's
what I'm saying is Batman and Robin is exactly as good as Mission Impossible. I was a little distracted just then because I was looking up part of the film. I'd written a note to go back and have a look at this exact moment.
Okay.
It's near the end where they're trying to hack the satellites to reflect the sunlight to thaw out Gotham.
Uh-huh.
There's a pop-up window, and it's only on screen for less than a second, and the version that I'm watching is probably less than VHS quality, I'd say. But it looks very much like this pop-up window says, "Display cat piss." And it would not surprise me if someone just put that in there as a little joke, because it's not even a second.
Display cat piss. Okay, yeah, why not? Was it frozen cat piss or?
Oh, it would be. There's frozen dog piss in this film.
There is indeed frozen dog piss. We've talked in other episodes about how Arnie always seems to try and get his character, whoever his character is, whether it's a a regular Joe American firefighter with an Austrian accent, all the way through to a futuristic helicopter pilot who's a regular American guy with an Austrian accent. He always seems to manage to get the stogie in there somehow.
Oh, yeah.
And in fact, going back to The Sixth Day, he actually comments, like, that son of a bitch, he's smoking my stogies. And in this one, he's also smoking a stogie, but get this, mate. In this one, the stogie is frozen. It's a frozen stogie.
That makes sense, because that's how physics works.
It is, but then how's it burning? Explain that, Jamie.
Deep heat? No, I don't know. Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? It's almost a microcosm of how seriously to take this film.
Mm-hmm.
They don't take note of how anything in the real world works. And in some ways, that means you're going to see a lot of stuff like that, like a frozen cigar that's on fire somehow, or Batman and Robin surfing from the stratosphere without choking to death or whatever would actually happen. But on the plus side, and this is what I think is the actual best thing about this film, Gotham looks amazing.
Do you know what? I'll agree with you on that. It's something where on rewatch... Right, okay. So, again, no secret. I've been saying all along that I hate this film and I've been dreading watching it. But I will admit that it made me laugh a couple of times. Not hearty, side-splitting laughter, but giggles.
Yeah.
And I'm fairly certain that they were intentional as well. Like, they intended to get laughs at that point in it. So I'll give it that. But yeah, I think the set design was bonkers in a way that I actually appreciated. I liked the fact that at one point there was a car chase where they were crashing through the head of a huge statue and then driving down its arm and then jumping off the arm onto rooftops. And how the entire end of the film as well was set in an observatory, which was sort of being held aloft like Atlas holding up the world.
Yeah, it's like a weird sort of mixture of Gothic architecture, city architecture, and sort of Greek myth.
On one of the interviews, and I guess you would have seen it because it sounds like we were watching the exact same stuff, but when he was asked about nipples on the Batsuit, he was like, I didn't think it was that weird because we were leaning into the sort of the Greek examples of like the perfect body. And if you look at those statues, they've got nipples on them. And so I didn't think it was this huge sort of thing. I didn't think it was huge. But again, it ties in aesthetically with the huge statues, like the big, almost like something out of like Jason and the Argonauts or those kind of
things.
Right,
yeah. It's also in keeping with like Burton's vision, because he, I don't know about the first one, but certainly in Batman Returns, there's the scene in the town square, in the city square or whatever it's called, where they're putting the Christmas tree up and there's two like symmetrical statues that are a lot smaller, but along the same lines as this.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is just obviously Joel Schumacher doubling down on that kind of thing and just absolutely going nuts with, well, it's probably not Joel Schumacher. I think it's John Dykstra who worked on this, who worked on Star Wars.
Right.
And there's a lot of stuff about how like they were using early CG and like to do the previs and then motion control cameras to go through the practical sets. And God, that kind of stuff, I could watch that forever.
Yeah, all the technical bits.
Miniature cities and explosions and stuff and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, really appreciate that. You got to take something from a film where there's no artistry other than the actual artistry, if you know what I mean.
Well, I remember you saying on a previous episode as well how nobody sets out to make a bad film.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that any film happens is a miracle in and of itself. And so, approaching this maybe with a bit more of a mature attitude, I can have those kind of feelings where, do you know what? Again, this just wasn't my Batman.
Mm-hmm.
But probably how I felt at the time when I was 14 and it first came out is, I did take it personally. I was like, this is not what I wanted. And I would have felt bad about that. Whereas, again, we've spoken before about how, aside from Batman, I'm a massive fan of like the Halloween films, and they are incredibly inconsistent with some terrible, terrible films. And yet, and like the remakes have come out, and they're really bad as well. But that's okay, because it's not taken away. The original is.
The other stuff still exists.
Again, I think with a more mature attitude, it's not like I'm not going to say that I like this film, or I like it any more than I did. But I don't find it as offensive, perhaps, as I used to. And I can now look at it maybe a little bit more objectively and find things that I do like in it, like, to your point, the set design. The theme music, which I think is the same theme music from Batman Forever, I think.
It's the same theme, I think. Yeah. Because I didn't realize until you pointed it out that it's not the one from the Batman 89 film.
No.
Because that one had been kind of reused for the animated series, hadn't it?
Yeah, a few of the cues off it had been anyway.
And the weird thing is, the music in this film isn't great, but the theme is.
Yeah.
It's not Danny Elfman, you can guarantee, because there was no point in a chase scene where it's going...
Well, as far as I recall, I think Danny Elfman, he walked with Tim Burton. Like, Tim Burton, he started doing Batman Forever, and then there was that breakup, and they went separate ways. I think everybody then went with Tim Burton. It's like, if Tim Burton's not going to do it...
Tim Burton
like,
took on the class with him.
Yeah, exactly right. Original music for this one, Elliot Goldenthal.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Elliot Gould. I was like, what? From MASH?
No. Elliot Goldenthal you may recognise from other masterpieces, such as Demolition Man.
Okay. We all remember the theme tune to that.
The 2003 cinema version of SWAT with LL Cool J, Sam Jackson, and Colin Farrell in it as well.
Okay.
I'll tell you what you'll recognise it from. You'll know it from his Final Fantasy, The Spirits Within film from 2001.
I remember it exists, but not something I've ever decided to watch.
1998 Sphere.
Oh, that's good. Oh, no, I'm thinking of Contact. Never mind. There's a sphere in it.
Yeah, so, to be fair, fucking Heat. He got lucky on that one. Anyway.
I've got a question for you, Gav.
Okay.
Do any Batman villains come about from anything other than falling into a vat or falling into the ground or some kind of submersion?
It is a pretty well-worn path in terms of, like, villain creation, really, isn't it?
Yeah. Because, like, Joker falls into a vat of chemicals, right? Mm-hmm. Doesn't Penguin fall into something and get retrieved by penguins?
Well, only into the sewer. So when he's a baby, he's sort of like Moses in the reeds sort of thing. He's put in his basket and floated off down the drain.
Okay.
But later on, he does get toxic waste poisoned at the end of the film.
I don't remember the Batman Forever stuff, but in this film... You've got Mr. Freeze falls into a massive open vat of... Was it meant to be... what's the thing from Terminator 2?
Liquid nitrogen or something like that.
Yeah.
No, they said it was something else. They said because it was something to do with the treatment that he was using to keep his wife alive or whatever. And
he's got McGregor syndrome.
Because they have like a CCTV of his lab and there's an explosion and electrical stuff and he falls into the vat.
And Poison Ivy, she doesn't fall into a vat, but she does fall into the ground and swallowed up by the earth. She kind of sinks into it in like Nancy's mum at the end of Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah. She falls into that and gets pulled in by plants, and it's venom. It's the same stuff they use for the Bane character. So it's like
I suppose Bane has a slightly different origin. A scrawny serial killer pumped full of plant toxins.
So he has like a nice sort of green, veiny hue to him.
Yeah, which isn't actually Bane, right?
No. Bane in the comics and even in the cartoon, I thought the version was pretty good. He's a guy who's born in this like horrible prison in somewhere in like South America or some island off the coast of South America. He's born into prison. His mum gets murdered when he's a small child and he has to just grow up becoming like physically and mentally and psychologically strong, and he educates himself reading books. And the idea is he has these nightmares about this like bat creature that comes to him, and like he's not afraid of anything, he's not afraid of the prisoners, but he has nightmares about this huge winged black creature that comes to him, and his whole thing is like he wants to crush and defeat his own fear. And then as part of his training, he then gets experimented on in the prison, and this is where the scientists test this venom stuff on him.
Oh, so that is part of his actual origin.
Oh yeah, the venom stuff is actually part of it, but it's not anything to do with Poison Ivy, it's just a separate thing.
Right.
He escapes from the prison. He seeks out Batman because he is like the last symbol of weakness, as Bane sees in himself. And so he wants to find Batman because he's like, he's going to defeat him. Because when he defeats Batman, then he's defeated his last fear and he's done. He's like complete. And so what Batman and Robin did is it took this complex character that has his own motivations, his own agency. He is supposed to be Batman's equal if not superior in terms of physical and mental prowess, but absolutely his superior in terms of his physical strength, before he even gets the venom pumping into him to make him this like mutated sort of like muscle man, they take this really complex character and go, ah, it's just some like skinny psychopath that we stick chlorophyll into.
And somehow it makes him dumber, because there's no way that that skinny little psychopath was going around going, boom, boom,
mate,
and just repeating to maximum of the words someone just said to him.
Yeah.
There's a moment where he's wearing a monkey costume. He's wearing like a big, a pink gorilla costume.
Well, they sneak into a party, don't they? Is it like that's how Poison Ivy and he sneak into the policeman's ball or whatever it is?
Yeah, but he shows up like way later after she's already revealed herself.
Yeah, he's just been there the entire time, just being a...
He's very much an afterthought, isn't he, in this film? He's like, he didn't need a third villain.
I can imagine Bane was in this for the same reason that Venom was in Sam Raimi's Spider-Man 3. In that it was popular at the time.
The studio needed it.
Yeah, popular at the time, and probably would have made a good action figure, and that would have been it.
Which is why they made him green rather than just a guy in a vest.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, he doesn't look too different to a wrestler, and I guess you wouldn't want to get him mixed up with wrestling figures.
Maybe, but he probably had the same sort of like, you know, they probably build him on the same model as some of the WWF figures that were out back in the day. You know, the idea that his arms are always sort of like, and his arms are sort of down by his side with his palms open, and then you crank his arms up, and then, I know, listeners can't see what I'm doing, but I'm raising my hands in the air like
I'm
enjoying
it.
And then, you know, you let go and it throws at the figure. Yeah, it's bullshit. Again, I remember that at the time. Like, I hadn't read the Bane comics when this came out. However, I had seen Batman the Animated Series with Bane in it. So I was excited to see Bane in this and disappointed.
Yeah. We haven't talked at all about Batgirl or a little bit about Alfred. Batgirl, Alicia Silverstone. Don't remember her ever being in a film after this. I'm sure she has been.
Well, from some of the stuff that I heard, and again, you may have seen some of the stuff if you've done some of the research, was that she got... Most of this was like pre-internet or pre-big internet. Like the internet was around, but it just would have been like shit little message boards. And apparently she early on got fitted for the Batgirl costume, but then between then and when they started filming, she put some weight on, so they had to make some alterations to the suit. And that got out into the press and the media, and apparently they were like the press and the media will be, is like really unkind, really unpleasant, because she'd put what is probably a tiny little bit of weight on. And so apparently she had a lot of scenes that were cut from this because of all that stuff. So she's not in this film as much as she should have been. Because she's in it for like altogether about 15 minutes of total screen time, if that.
Yeah, much more than any kind of weight issue. Maybe it could have been a criticism is that she's meant to be English and in no way sounds English.
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure if they necessarily explicitly said either way. But again, that could be something that was in one of the deleted scenes.
Maybe, yeah.
Is it that Alfred's brother?
I think sister, because he says at one point, you look just like your mother.
Right.
And he's like very fond of her, so I assume he's not just
could have still
talking
been
about his brother's wife.
Oh, Alfred. This is why no else in the family's coming to see him when he's ill.
It would have been quite funny if on his deathbed he made a load of confessions and then just like next day they found a cure for this incurable disease.
Oh no! Barbara, seeing as I'm going to die tomorrow and there's absolutely no chance of there being a cure, it's important you know I am your father. Bruce walks in. Take two of these. See you in the morning.
That's literally a line as well.
It
isn't
is.
It? That's
yeah.
Like it's Mr. Freeze. Mr. Freeze does he doesn't have a redemption arc, but he does have a similar to Dr. Octopus in Spider-Man 2, where it's like he's actually not a bad guy. He's just gone down really far down this path, which is obviously part of his nuanced performance, where you can see the torture he's going through, the mental anguish while he's saying things like "You're not sending me to the cooler."
Yeah. Really briefly, it looks like Alicia Silverstone has still carried on acting fairly consistently through the years. Never seen Scooby-Doo 2, Monsters Unleashed?
Surprisingly, I haven't.
But yeah, I think she got treated really, really unfairly from what I've heard on this one.
Well, that sucks.
But at least, you know, Joel Schumacher gave her much more subtle nipples on her batsuit.
Yes, he said he was... he didn't want to have like be accused of a double standard, but he also realised there probably is a difference.
Yeah.
Maybe it would have been an odd choice anyway, but this film opens with a montage of like crotch and butt scenes, and then they do another one for Alicia Silverstone later on when she finally gets suited up. Incidentally, she becomes Batgirl because Alfred has recorded his likeness into a virtual reality thing on the Bat computer.
Yep.
Because she hacks it using the incredibly difficult to guess password. God, I've actually forgotten what it was.
Peg.
Peg. That was it.
Based on his favourite sex act.
So, like, she becomes Batgirl because he's got really bad cybersecurity skills. And that's all.
And, well, no, it's not just that. It's also based on the off chance that when he's just about to die, she will mysteriously turn up out of the blue, having not phoned ahead, him having not seen her for years, I guess, potentially, since she was a small girl. Just on the off chance she turns up, he has downloaded himself into the Bat computer and then designed her a Batgirl costume.
Mm-hmm.
That's all it took.
Last week, I set my living will in very similar fashion for any future children I might have, or, you know, like godchildren or nephews and nieces. All of them have got a costume waiting to go. Can you answer me these riddles three? I thought it was standard practice.
Maybe it is. Going back to Alfred and his diet, like, there's various points in this one where he's having a full-on conversation with Bruce or Barbara or Dick, and then the conversation sort of finishes. They walk off, and then he just turns around and goes like, just in case it wasn't clear that he was dying. And then when he gets the cure and he comes back in the next morning, and he's like ready to get back to work. And I'm thinking, that's not funny, because that's what we're all going to be like when it comes to retirement, as in we can't retire.
90 years old, and it's like, yes, I'm definitely fine with coming back to full-time work.
Exactly.
Doing all the hard work for a billionaire.
It's like just when you thought you were going to die, it's like, no, we've got a cure. Make us some tea.
I actually think that the women in this film very progressive for the era, because Poison Ivy's all about, you know, saving the planet, making sure all our research is towards, I guess it would have been more focused on sort of like stopping the rainforest from being destroyed or whatever at the time. But long term, it's all related to climate change.
Yeah, she's like a proto Just Stop Oil protester.
Yeah, 100%. Except she's a lot happier to have a whole bunch of people die in the process, which, if that wasn't part of her plan, would make Batman the villain for saying no, or Bruce Wayne the villain for saying no to funding the research. Mm. But also, Alicia Silverstone, Barbara, whatever her surname is, it's not Barbara Gordon, is it? It's Barbara whatever.
Pennyworth, I guess.
I guess so. When she turns up, she's turned up basically because somehow she knows that Alfred's dying. Maybe, yeah, I don't know, maybe his VR self appeared in one of her emails. But she's turned up because she's basically explicitly saying, he's an old man who's dying and he's working for a billionaire and you guys have got no idea what he's going through. He's too polite and old-fashioned to kind of speak up about being put out by you guys, but you're rich and you need to be sorting this out. And I'm like, yeah, I'm on her side as well.
Yeah. Well, also because then later on, Bruce Wayne comes back in. Literally when she's saying that, Bruce Wayne walks in and he's like, it's because he's dying. Like he knew it.
Oh yeah, she says he's sick.
Yeah.
And he's not sick, he's dying. Oh, well, okay, world's greatest detective, do something about it then. Yeah, it's...
he's dying and my clothes haven't been washed in a week.
It's genuinely crazy. Like, anyone else would go, oh, he's dying. Well, then I'll pay for him to not work and I'll hire someone else. Mm. Turns out, I've got a bit of money.
Yeah.
Famously, on the breadline, Bruce Wayne can't afford to get a second butler. I mean, I guess Alfred knows about Batman, that's the only thing. But, like, so does Alicia Silverstone. She just turns up in a mask and goes, Bruce, it's me, Barbara. Yeah, it clearly is.
I mean, if they're going to lean into the idea that you can't tell who they are with those tiny little domino masks, then it would have fooled him.
I guess so.
So the film finishes really in terms of, like, Arnold's final contribution is he's back in his cell, but... I guess that he's got his suit back on, because when they first put him in his cell earlier on, he has to stay under that beam of cool air or whatever it is. To he tries to escape outside the beam and he collapses and he can't do it. So I guess they give him his suit so he can roam freely around his cell and conduct his research. And so he has that freedom, at least. He can keep doing his research to save his wife on the condition that, you know, as a thank you, I suppose, for saving Alfred.
Oh, that's why they... Right, because I thought that the armor was like... I guess it doesn't have any inherent powers, does it? It's like his freeze rays and stuff.
It's just so we can move around and stay cool.
Right.
So yeah, I think that's why the last time we see him, he's there to continue doing his research.
And also beat the shit out of Poison Ivy for almost killing his wife.
Well, that's it, because we think Poison Ivy's dead, like she's been eaten by one of her plants, but she hasn't. She's just been chewed a little bit.
Yeah, and she's kind of gone back to her... Pamela Isley is a civilian name.
All right. Any sort of final words? I think we've pretty much we've done it.
We've exhausted pretty much every aspect of this film, which is an exhausting film.
It's kind of weird because I think when we talked about Predator, we talked about the idea that actually Predator, it's not really a Schwarzenegger film. Like, he's the main character in it, but that film doesn't center around him specifically as the main protagonist.
No, it needed a person like him to be in it, but it didn't need to be Arnold necessarily.
Yeah, and then I kind of feel like this is another... I'm not, by the way, trying to put this in the same ballpark as Predator, because it's not. But maybe this is another one where it's not a Schwarzenegger film, but he's kind of a big presence in it. But he's got top billing, he's in it quite a lot, he doesn't do a lot in it.
It makes more of an impression than George Clooney, though.
It's true. And do you know what? George Clooney, you know, he takes a lot of responsibility for this film. He apologises for it frequently. And one of the bits of trivia I read, I don't know how true it is, but George Clooney has refunded people their ticket. I like the idea, like, maybe almost 30 years later, he's still giving people, like, $5 bills to set to apologise for them going watching this film.
Or, like, a voucher for a Nespresso machine.
That's what it's going to be these days, isn't it? So, shall we wrap it up? Shall we rate this thing?
Yeah, why not?
So, normally when we rate one of these films, we rate it on a binary rating scale.
With nuance.
And we will say, if we think that you should watch this film, we will say, do it now. And if we think that you shouldn't watch this film, we will say, put the cookie down. And then we'll explain a little bit of our justification for our rating. So, Jamie, for 1997's Batman and Robin, do it now or put the cookie down?
It's a weird one.
Fucking hell. Is it?
It is, because, I mean, you'd think it would be about as put the cookie down as you can get. And certainly there were parts where I was watching this film and thinking, can't be much left, surely. If you didn't have, like, a progress bar, you might never know at what point in the film you're at. But it rattles along, and I was never actually bored. There's no kind of, like, forward momentum with the story. It's nonsense, and there's no reason to look forward to the next scene. But there's stuff like the set dressing, the production design. So in a lot of ways, the stuff that I like about it is just the backgrounds. And, you know, I admire when someone fully commits to knowing what film they're in, like Arnold and like Uma Thurman. And there's certain other things about this. Like, there's a very short scene where Poison Ivy and Bane find their lair, and it's been inhabited by some guys dressed in Dayglow face paint, but all over.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really cool visual. And they're only in it for, like, literally to be thrown out the door. That kind of stuff, I could have used more of that. There's a street racing bit with, like, motorbikes.
Oh, yeah.
That's relatively interesting. With, like, an Underworld, or I think, Underworld soundtrack.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
So there's, like, little moments, there's little nuggets in here that may... I wasn't clock-watching like I have with, you know, like, Jingle All the Way or The Iron Mask or probably a couple of others. Even, like, stuff like End of Days. What do I do? Okay, I'm going to say, do it now, but one time only.
Okay.
You're going to have to experience this. Because it is everything you've heard. And sometimes it's like rubbernecking. It's fun to watch a pile-up on the motorway. It's not fun. That's a horrible thing to say. It's an interesting thing to watch a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
And when there are things in it to like, you kind of take them. You know, like, I'll take what I can get kind of thing.
Yeah.
One of which is when the cops are being frozen with, like, some kind of gas thing near the end. Someone actually says, "Ah, my lungs!" And that kind of thing. I love it.
We've all been there.
You know, it. Yeah. I feel like I'm going to regret this, but do it now.
One time only.
One time only. And then have a shower and watch something good.
Okay.
Go on, surprise me.
Surprise you. So, believe it or not, I agree with most of what you said. I was the same. There was a point where I checked the time, but it was more out of curiosity than when we talked before about Jingle All the Way, when it must be nearly over. It's only 40 minutes through, it's only halfway. With this one, I agree with you. It's it keeps moving. And I agree, there was never really a point where I was bored. I was bewildered. I was confused. I was frustrated. But if nothing else, that kept me engaged, if not interested. So yeah, it's... I don't know. It's been a weird one for me because I think I've built this up over the years and throughout the time we've been doing this podcast to be my white whale of a Schwarzenegger film and to be absolutely dreading it. And I think by the time we got done watching it, I was like, do you know what? It's not as bad as I remember it. Or maybe that's wrong. Maybe it's exactly as bad as I remember it. But I've seen more bad films since. And this maybe goes back to something you were talking about earlier, and I was thinking at the time, is that we've had so many superhero films now that the spectrum of quality across those films has stretched out massively, and the bell curve of quality on those films has shifted. And so maybe back in 1997, when we looked at like superhero films that we'd had, we hadn't had that many. You know, we'd had the Superman films, and even only maybe the first two of them were any good. We'd had the first two Batman films, and they were pretty good, and Batman Forever was all right. But what else did we had? We'd also had like the Captain America TV movie, the Spider-Man pilot thing, where he had like the watering...
Oh, the Nicholas Hammond ones.
Yeah, where he had like the watering can covers for eyes. And
does stuff like Dick Tracy.
Exactly, right. So I suppose what I'm saying is that on a long enough timeline, this film starts to look more and more like a masterpiece when we look at it in relation to many, many other superhero films that have come out over the years. What am I going to say? I'm probably going to say Do It Now.
Holy crap!
but it's only, it's maybe one of the, I don't know about one of the few times, but I think just you and I are on exactly the same page. Just as like a curioso, just watch it. If you've never seen this film, and you want to see Arnold clearly having fun, trying to do something with the time that he's got, which again, I believe he'd had his heart surgery for the same reason he had to do Jingle All the Way. And it's, you've got this thing where he's had his heart surgery. He knows he's not doing his action films anymore. He wants to do something for his kids. If you want to see that, then watch it. He's having fun. He's having a good time. He's doing something that you don't normally see him do. Because I could say put the cookie down, but I wonder if... we are now at the point, and I feel like maybe we talked about this when we watched it as well, Jamie, that I wonder if we're at the point now where we can look back at this and watch it almost ironically. We can watch it as just like, do you know what? I'm full of a cold, or I'm feeling sick, or I've got a hungover. I just want to watch something where I can laugh at it, at how bad it is. Maybe we're there.
Yeah, I think maybe we are. I'm not a big fan of kind of watching things ironically as a rule. It's like I'm never going to be one of those people who goes to like a screening of The Room and you know, or Sharknado or anything like that. But something where it wasn't intended to be stupid, or you know, like something that at least had some effort and some love behind it, and an aesthetic and a direction. It's not for me, but I appreciate that they tried.
Yeah, they took a swing, and they missed.
Yeah, they missed massively and hilariously. And once in a while, I'll probably return to this and just kind of, maybe not watch all of it, but I'll certainly skip through to the fun bits.
Yeah.
Any of the bits that don't have Batman and Robin in it, really.
Literally. YouTube, Mr. Freeze, best lines.
Yep.
So, Bombshell. Shocker. Possibly the most dramatic moment of the podcast so far.
Yeah, it's a real bit of character development for you there, guy.
Mate, what an arc. What a fucking arc. And do you know what? I don't feel as dirty as I thought I would saying it. Do it now, but you know what? You've been warned. It's not great, but it's something. It's something.
It's the circus. Well then, who'd have thought we'd get through it?
I know. This, I feel like it's been a long time coming. I'm glad it's done. I am hoping...
What would be the worst case scenario for the next film to come up in terms of what you don't want to see?
Do you know what? I hesitantly say that the worst is behind us.
Come on, most people hate Terminator Genesis though, right?
Yeah, but I don't know it being that bad.
I don't trust anyone's opinion since they started doing things for YouTube clicks.
Not at all. Do you know what? There's nothing on this list where I'm looking at it thinking, dreading it. Do you know what? Bring it on. Whatever it is, I'm ready for it.
He's got a new lease of life.
Okay, shall we find out what we are going to be watching and talking about next time?
I reckon we should probably spin a wheel that is of pain.
Let's do it. In the next episode, we are going to be watching and talking about... Junior!
You had a big smile on your face when you saw what it was. And I was like, oh, it's going to be something like Terminator 2. I don't really have any kind of opinion on this whatsoever. How about you?
Nah, I've seen it. I remember some of it. It's...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, why not?
It's Schwarzenegger and DeVito again.
It is.
And Emma Thompson, is that right?
That's quite right, yeah. As one of the doctors in it.
Cool. Great.
And I do you know what?
I had so much to say about Batman and Robin, I'm going to have nothing to say about this.
This is it. I strongly suspect that's what the entire episode is going to be about. He's like, so is it, do it now or put the cookie down? And we're like, whatever. Both? Neither? It's going to be a 15-minute episode.
I feel like this is going to be like the margarine of films. It's just going to be like, yeah, it's there.
It's better than dry bread.
Yeah. I'm saying that. I've got literally no idea. I'm just... these kind of films generally take two watches for me. I didn't watch Batman and Robin twice because no one should. But I feel like this is going to be one where I'm going to have to watch it twice before making a decision on... If it's anything like Kindergarten Cop and Twins, then it's going to be a fairly sort of gentle affair that I'm not going to appreciate very much the first time. And then the second time, I'll love it.
Okay. That's something to look forward to.
Yeah.
Right, so that is a setup for the next episode. If you want to get in touch with us, you can find us on the socials on Instagram at Pod Action Hero.
We're also at Pod Action Hero on Letterboxd. And if you do us a favour and leave us a rating and a review on the podcast apps that allow you to do that, then I will download myself into your computer as a virtual version of me, and I will assist you in becoming the superhero that you deserve to be. But I will also see everything that you've got on your computer.
And with that chilling warning, I've been Gavin.
I've been Jamie.
And we will speak to you again next time.